Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the January 9th Heretics Hour program, coming to you live from Voice of Reason. I have two excellent guests for you tonight, but first I'm going to read a section from The Fire, The Bombing of Germany, 1940 to 1945. You know, if you listened last week, you know I began that, and I said I would continue it for one segment of the program every week until I think I've done enough, which might be quite a bit because I'm still right in the very beginning. But I'm doing this because, you know, I have read this and I've thought about it. Of course, I've been aware of this for a long time, and it's a subject that I just want to draw attention to, and I don't know any better way to do it than this. So, also, I want to say that, part of the reason that I'm doing it is that, well, you know that our Jewish friends have a saying, never forget, never forgive. They are referring to what they call the Jewish Holocaust. So I'm going into detail into the German Holocaust so that Germanophiles, like some of you and like myself and those maybe who aren't, but will themselves take that motto, take that motto for ourselves and hold on to it. Never forget, never forgive. This is my attitude, I have to admit, when it comes to something like what happened to Germany before, during, and after World War II. Now, before I get into my reading, and then we're going to have a very interesting show, so don't go away, stay with me here and listen to this bombing material I'm going to give you. It's very interesting. But before I get into that, I want to say one little thing. You know, I've talked about the so-called Zwickau, I keep pronouncing it wrong, Zwickau, so-called terror cell in Germany of these three people, and they're trying very hard to find some more people to add to it. And this Beate Chape, who is in custody, in prison, being held without any charges yet because they're trying to come up with them. And her lawyers, as I put out in a newsletter a while back, her lawyers, have criticized her detention. And there was, that she should not be detained as she's being because they don't have any proper evidence against her. But, there was a story in the Deutsche Welle German newspaper just very recently that reiterated what her lawyers have said, and they said that she was suffering. She's 36 years old. She was suffering from exhaustion while in detention because of nighttime illumination. They have a light on 24 hours a day in her cell. Searches, so I guess they go and search her whenever they feel like it, as well as spitting and threats by other inmates. Now, if her lawyers put this into a brief that they presented to the court, I imagine there has to be truth in it. And just imagine that she has TV and radio, so I guess the others do too. They're aware of what the news is, so they watch that, and they see how this is being played up, that she is a part of a group who murdered nine Turks or eight Turks and one or two something else. If they are Turks, some of these female prisoners, or if they are some foreigner, you know, not German, or even if they are Germans and real liberal minded or something, you know, then they get this, they think that she's some, terrible Nazi because they've been indoctrinated that way. And so I guess she's having to put up with that too. I thought that was worth mentioning. Well, tonight, I'm going to read starting on page 7. This book is almost 500 pages and I'm still, what I read was prior to page 7. But last week I was talking, I was reading mostly about what the experience of the people on the ground was in this particular town of Wuppertal that was bombed, and also the part of either a nearby town or a part of Wuppertal is Barmen, and then there was Elberfeld, this whole little area here. So there was a part that I skipped, and I'm going to read this part today because I decided I should read it, and then I'm going to go on into where it talks about how the Air Ministry of in London was working on developing this method of fire raising through their bombing. You know, it's very kind of scientific, at least it's technical material, but it's easy to understand. It's very interesting. So I'm going to begin here. 9-year-old Wilfred Pickard had observed the attack from an attic window in Elberfeld in the south of Wuppertal. The next morning in Barmen, he confronted, quote, death for the first time in my life, unquote. He had heard stories that the corpses of the people who burned to death shrunk down to the size of dolls. So he was surprised by the normal size of a, quote, woman lying face down close to the curb, undressed, and with totally blackened skin, unquote. Heinrich Biergan, a 16-year-old trainee with the German railroad, had a truck driver's license and was assigned to recover corpses. Quote from him, they'd say, here are 6 corpses, there are 20, etc. Sometimes the people lay there totally at peace, as if asleep. They had been asphyxiated due to a lack of oxygen. Others had been completely incinerated. The charred bodies measured about 20 inches. We recovered them in zinc bathtubs and washtubs. 3 fit into one washtub and 7 or 8 into a bathtub. That's the end of that quote. It was hard for Biergan to look at those who were partially burned. An arm, for instance, that lay under the rubble was left uncharred. Quote, corpses of the normal burn victims didn't resemble human beings very much. They were like black packages. But if an undamaged body part was attached, you were suddenly aware that these were people. We often had to down a potent gulp in order to cope with the strain, unquote. Fischertal, a densely built-up quarter of Barmen, suffered the most severe losses. On one property on Zughausstrasse, a whole neighborhood of 32 people had been erased. Identification of the corpses was difficult if entire families had been exterminated. In such a case, the cemetery administration simply noted descriptive details on their casualty list. These are some examples. Female, blue and white checkered dress, wedding ring, no teeth, black lace shoes. Female, charred torso, petticoat, gold tooth. Boy, roughly 13 years old, black Widewell corduroy trousers, russet jacket, herringbone pattern, and girl, charred. And finally, 2 skulls of adults and 2 children's skulls. Okay, I'm going to move now over to the next page and start on this area, the part where he's going into how the Air Ministry was figuring out how to perfect this kind of fire raising in these German cities. When the researchers at the Air Ministry consulted engineers from the fire departments, a new science was born. The occupation of fighting fires and that of setting fires both dealt with the same subject, the flammability of the materials. Fire raising required knowledge of the physical composition of the German settlement, or in other words, where the Germans were living. The bomb had to burn for between 8 and 30 minutes at the point of impact. That was the time needed for the seed to germinate. Determining how that seed spread, how the fire grew, how it passed over obstructions, crossed areas without streets, and caught hold of an area for miles were the jobs for the mathematicians, statisticians, and operation evaluators. Fire engineers investigated the properties of German furnishings, since the first thing to catch fire were the contents of the houses. Junk in attics, food in pantries, clothing, cushions, this inventory in turn set the building on fire. The engineers ordered fire insurance maps and prepared stereometric images of aerial photographs in order to draw conclusions about the locations of fire cells and firewalls, which are the barriers that slow a fire down. Skipping ahead now, I'm on page 10 now. In 1940 and 41, the bomber pilot had two terms for his drop, hit or miss. 2 years later, a different war was being waged. That's like 43. Research staff studied survey maps of developed areas and aerial photographs of built-up areas, marked the fire cells in color, and calculated the necessary tonnage combinations that had to be dropped for the respective cities. Afterward, they evaluated pictures of that raid and adjusted those combinations before the next drop or raid. When a bomber released its load, a photo flash bomb was also dropped, which activated a camera. The next day, reconnaissance planes photographed the results. The war of strategists and war horses had always consisted of a combination of factual experience, ideas, and intuition. Now the precision of the laboratory was added to that mixture. As it turned out, it was indeed possible to burn down entire cities from the air, even German cities solidly built of brick. As regards ignition, the relevance of a city increased as one moved from the periphery to the center. The outer ring was built in the 19th and 20th centuries using modern construction techniques. It contained the industrial area and residential developments. Steel girders were used, fire cells were built, and wide spaces were surrounded by buildings. That was the outer ring. Further in toward the center of the major German metropolises were sprawling neighborhoods of unsound and substandard buildings, often hastily built during the period of rapid industrial expansion in the late 1800s. These dismal buildings let in little air, absorbed heat well, and burned quickly. Within that was the 18th century city with its grid-like pattern of streets and 3 to 6 story buildings with shared separating walls. They were built with wooden beams, and the ceilings between the floors were stuffed with filling material. Roof ridges ran parallel to the streets and overlapped. Within that was the old town, the city hub, whose layout traced back to medieval or early modern building patterns. The streets were narrow, crooked, and winding. Beam frames held the buildings rigid. They were filled in with brick, replacing the loam that had originally been used. That loam still remained in patches. Separating walls were crafted together such that they could easily spread fire from neighbor to neighbor. The attics were partitioned using large amounts of wood. Wherever such old town hubs existed, they were a natural target, and they served as a kindling for the surrounding areas. The city block was recognized to be the Achilles heel of the extended inner district. Originally a row of residential apartments, it evolved into a hybrid design with shops and commercial enterprises on the ground floor. The buildings quickly expanded, taking over what previously had been courtyards and open spaces. Overfilled warehouses and workshops, often made of wood, made excellent fire bridges. A flame needs tight spaces and streets that are far narrower than the buildings are high. The bomb's chances of falling onto an inflammable area increased as open spaces, front yards, and undeveloped sites disappeared. The buildings faithfully placed their most ignitable part on top, facing the bombardier's sites directly. With its brick and timber work structure, the roof made it possible to set a fire that worked downward. It took a long time, about 3 hours per floor. It was also possible to set the detonation point lower. It all depended on the fuse settings. The bomb could crash through 3 or 4 floors with its weight, then ignite on the wooden floors. All that was missing was a draft. After the 4,000-pound blockbuster blew away all the roofs and windows for miles around, the buildings became chimneys and the incendiaries dropped in. The German cellar provided a safe refuge built either with brick vaulting or with concrete casting and steel girders. The cellar ceilings offered excellent protection against explosions. It was defenseless only against the seeping in of combustion gases and the subsequent loss of oxygen. At first, the attackers did not know what was happening in the cellars. Well, in the cellars, they were being gassed. Talking about the gassing and gas chambers, this is me now, during the war, in the concentration camps. Here in the cities, the German civilians were being gassed in their cellars while the bombing raids were going on. Well known, on the other hand, were the effects of intervention by firefighters. If they arrived in time, the fire never crossed beyond the block in which it started. A wide area fire resulted only if the fire department failed. Firemen needed access to two things, the fire and water. Explosive bombs kept the firemen from both. With overly heavy heads at the front and guidance fins in the back, the explosive bombs drilled deep into the earth, tearing apart the water mains. They also cratered the street, making it impassable. However, these effects lasted only for a short time. Water could be tapped from rivers and from reservoirs set up as a precaution, and rubble could be cleared away. So lighter, duller shrapnel bombs with a timed fuse were also used. They lay on the ground, detonating and hurling their bullet-like fragments for hours after the attacker had left the scene. That is, after the planes, the bomber planes had left. These time bombs forced firefighters to remain in the shelters or be wiped out. Bomb researchers were unceasingly concerned with the complex process of mixing and calibrating the materials to be dropped. The flammability of the target over time and across space was one thing. There was also the effect of natural elements such as temperature, humidity, and wind to consider. And human nature confused everything. The pilots could not be programmed as perfectly as the chemical mixtures of the bombs. Incalculable portions of their load regularly landed on unintended sites. It did not help much to calculate behavioral variables into the plans. The pilots were too unpredictable. Quantity was the bomber's quality assurance. The targets were hopelessly inundated with bombs, and dozens of sorties were flown. Post-war inspections described the country as overbombed. Well, I thought I would get past there in the first part, but here I still have time, so I will continue. Fires were initially started not to damage, but to illuminate the target area for the explosive bombs. However, post-raid aerial photographs showed that although 7,000 tons of explosive ammunition could damage a radius of almost 20 miles, the damage caused by the same amount of incendiary materials could extend more than 90 miles. By the summer of 1943, it had been empirically determined that a city was easier to burn down than to blow up. So, therefore, both the explosive and incendiary bombs were needed to produce a sufficient blaze. Before that, a whole range of bombs had been dropped. Some of them worked, some did not. So now they had found the secret of what would work for them. I'm going to go forward a couple more pages now to page 18. Nevertheless, realize I've skipped a couple of pages here, so we're starting out with some statistics. Nevertheless, the 2.7 million tons of bombs that the Western Allies dropped on European theaters of war, that is then not just Germany, 2.7 million tons of bombs, 1,356,828 tons of which fell on Germany, represented an enormous production battle. The entire Allied apparatus of science, technology, industry, and logistics put bombers in the air 1,440,000 times and put escort fighter planes into the air 2,680,000 times over this theater of war. This was the greatest military entity of all time. In the period from 1944 to 1945, the European Air War involved more than 1.8 million personnel. In the British Bomber Command, the true air fleet of the Fire War, bomb carriers or fighter planes threw 389,809 sorties. Bomber Command flew operations on 1,481 nights and 1,089 days. So that's about 2,500 days. And we're talking about 44 to 45, 1 year, that Germany, I think this part is just about Germany, I'm not sure, but was being bombed. That's a lot of days and nights. Britain spent almost half of its war expenses on the Air Force. The United States spent 35%. The aircraft that made the British and American air offensive possible was the heavy bomber. In England, its design had been worked on since 1924. The bomber types used in World War II were almost all produced or designed in the 1930s. Let's be aware that in 1924, Germany was prohibited from developing anything beyond a 100,000-man army, and was prohibited from doing any of these things. Plus, it was had no money to do anything, while the British, the Americans, and the French were building up their armed forces. That was me. Now, continuing with the book, the task of the heavy bomber was to penetrate deep into enemy territory. Its weight came from its load as well as from the large tanks of fuel needed for extended round-trip flights. Armor plating and aircraft cannons were also necessary for defense against attacks from fighter planes and anti-aircraft fire. The two best bomber planes at the end of the war, the American B-17 and the British Lancaster, weighed 25 tons when fully loaded. The bomber, let's see my time here. Okay, the bomber was a highly vulnerable vehicle by day and even by night. As a bringer of fire, it was by no means fireproof. Filled as it was with 2,500 gallons of high-octane fuel and a load of high explosive and incendiary bombs, machine gun ammunition, and flares and markers. With its limited speed and maneuverability, it had little hope of getting away if sighted by a fighter plane, and certainly no chance of prevailing in a dogfight. The plan to fly in squadrons and in close formations was not implemented until May 1942, because for a long time it seemed more logical that individual planes could slip through unnoticed and thus unscathed under cover of night and in the vastness of the sky. I think I'm going to move ahead if I can find something else I have marked, but I may not have marked anything more. Nope. So we're going to read some parts next week, I believe, from later on, from a little further on, about how vulnerable these bombers were and how many were lost by the English. The British in the beginning, and how angry they got about that, because the Germans were doing a very good job of shooting down from the ground and also with the fighter planes. So being a British bomber pilot at the time was very dangerous, and there's a real good part further on where it talks about that, but I'm not prepared with that for today. So what I'm going to do, I've got a couple of minutes left. I'm going to tell you about my guests for tonight. This will be the end of my reading for tonight in this book. I hope you got something from that. I'm going to tell you that, maybe I should have said right in the beginning, my guests tonight are Charles Kraft and George Stimson. And if you didn't see the announcement for tonight's show, I will say that the title of tonight's show is Political Social Design in the Third Reich. And Charles Kraft is an artist, very, very creative person, and a person who has a lot of friends, and I'm something of, we're sort of friends, although I've never met him in person, but I've seen his artwork, and I'm going to ask him about that. He's very creative. And George Stimson I've met for the first time, and he edits a Militaria Collectors magazine. So he's going to come on in the second hour, right in the next segment. We're going to have just Charles, and Charles is going to talk about mostly about the porcelain art that was done in the Third Reich, which is really German porcelain manufacturing has a long history, and it was put to work for the political social ideas of the National Socialists and their work and so on. So, just to give an overview of all the things we can talk about, we may have to go on into next week. Posters, flags, banners, all the plaques and figurines and presentation objects and so on. So we'll go along with that. We'll have Charles with us when we come back, ladies and gentlemen. Stay with me.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Diplomats have confirmed Iran's begun enriching uranium at a brand new nuclear facility. The West has slammed the move as a provocation at a time when brinksmanship between the U.S. and Iran has reached boiling point. Let's now get some more on this from Patrick Henderson, Associate Editor from Infowars.com. Thank you for coming on the program today. Before we get into the issue of uranium enrichment with Iran, the latest angle I want to take with you is this. As we know, for the past week or so, in fact it was 10 days in the very recent past, Iran was staging naval military war games in the Gulf. We're now hearing the U.S. and Israel are gearing up for joint military exercises in the Gulf as well. It's just as Tehran announces it will surely stage what it's calling, quote, the greatest war games ever seen in the region. Who's pushing who here, do you think?
You know what? This looks vaguely familiar to power politics and power geopolitics that we saw pre-1991. I'm talking about the Cold War, Rory. Look, the main subject here we're looking at is we saw in the last week a direct reaction in the world oil markets. We saw prices spike. Price of oil per barrel is going up, okay? This is real creation of wealth for the oil industry. I do not see the timetable right now with Iran as being on schedule for a preemptive attack from the United States and or Israel. I see this as drawing out over a longer period.
All right, now let's go back to the issue of diplomats confirming Iran has begun enriching uranium at a brand new nuclear facility. The International Atomic Energy Agency says it's unable to verify that Iran's nuclear program remains peaceful. Why then has Tehran decided to push ahead with launching this new facility, which experts say could produce pre-weapons-grade uranium?
Well, again, this all depends on your perspective. If you're an expert from the International Atomic Energy Agency or the UN, you'll see this as a possible move towards building a nuclear weapon. If you're an expert from a neutral party, you might see it as something with regards to nuclear power. Also, you have to not ignore the fact that part of Iran's industrial nuclear program has to do with the medical industry, okay? Iran is pushing forward to be a leader in technology as far as medicine and pharmaceuticals, and also this is a base requirement to do some of this kind of activity industrially, okay? So we can't ignore that, like any other country would pursue such an ambition.
So as we've seen, Iran conducting 10 days of naval exercises in the Gulf, the West and the International Atomic Agency bearing down on Tehran over its nuclear ambitions. The Iranian president is currently visiting his allies in South America. How much international support does Iran really have at this point? And how is that affecting the situation in the Gulf region? Is it becoming more isolated, possibly?
I think the
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. And I'm here now with Charles Kraft, who some of you, I'm sure, know him or are familiar with his name. He has something he calls Via Delirium Deltworks. Charles is a very creative, inventive artist. I'm going to ask him to talk about that just a little bit before we get into the German Third Reich design. Hi, Charles.
Hello, Carolyn.
Well, wonderful to have you here.
Well, thank you for having me on your program.
Well, it was your idea to talk about the designs in the Third Reich, and I picked right up on it because it's something that I really love, and I've had a great time the last few days looking over lots of pictures. There's of artwork all over the internet of designs, and I love design. That's probably my first. What I love the most in visually is just wonderful design. And you have been, you're a designer and an artist, so tell us about your own art and your art career.
I started out as a painter, and around 1967 was when I had my first exhibition, and I continued to be a salon painter until about 1992, and I switched mediums in 92 and went from painting on canvas to painting on ceramics and making ceramics. And the inspiration for that was a auto pinstriper from Southern California named Von Dutch. And he was sort of big when I was a kid as a hot rod maker and car painter and motorcycle rider. And I got in touch with him to let him know through the mails, this was before the internet, how he had impacted my life as a young teenager. And then I sort of drifted into art as a result of being interested in seeing what he had been, what he was doing with cars. We corresponded, and I made him a tile portrait of himself in the Dutch Delft blue and white style, which I sent to him as a token of my respect. And in order to make that tile, I had to take a class in China painting because I didn't know how to paint on ceramic surfaces. So I joined this lady's China painting class, and I had a really good time with these gals for a winter learning how to paint on plates. And that just led into more and more interest in ceramics and the history of ceramics and ceramics production. So I ended up kind of becoming the token ceramist in what they call the pop surrealism movement, which is kind of a underground kids graphics movement that started in Southern California and has spread across the globe now. And the inspiration for a lot of the imagery that is used in lowbrow or pop surrealism art comes from pulp magazine covers and hot rod flame jobs and monster movies and that kind of thing. It's very populist oriented, circus posters, tattoos, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. I don't see a lot of that on your ceramic art. And tell people where they can you give an internet address where they can go and just the best one to see your artwork?
Well, what they should probably just do is Google my name. I spell my name mm-hmm. with two Fs, K-R-A-F-F-T. Yes. Put Charles Kraft in your Google search engine and then hit the mm-hmm. images button up there on the right.
Yes,
That'll open up a couple of pages of pictures of my work. Then you can just click on the sources for the images you like, and that would be one way to see what I do.
That's very good advice. That's the right way to do it. Okay. Well, then, you have had quite a few. We have to get onto our subject, but I should really have you guys just talk about your art sometime. But we have You have had several shows. You recently, not too long ago, had a one-man show in London.
Yeah.
I know. Was that your last one?
Yes, that was the last one-man show.
Okay.
2010.
Yeah, 2010. Okay, well, what? Just for the question, are you working on some new stuff now, and what is it?
Well, I'm working right now. I'm getting ready for a ceramic teachers convention that's coming to Seattle, which is where I live, and it's going to be a big deal for all the educators in ceramics across America. They're coming here, and I'm involved in about 5 different group shows, and I'm making new work for those shows, and I'll be lecturing at the convention. It's called NSECA.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Now, you also have a great interest in World War II historical revisionism and all that that entails. Would that be correct to say that?
Yes, I do. I'm very interested in it.
Yeah, that's how I got to know you, and I just learned about you as an artist as an aside. But quite some time back, and I really do appreciate the work that you do. It's really excellent. It's a high quality craftsmanship. Now we're going to talk about craftsmanship in the German art world, and this I'm separating this from the art that I've talked about previously on this program, Third Reich art in German. Well, art and painting and sculpture and so on in Germany. This is more in the sense of design, and I'm calling it political. And then I added the word social because it's quite kind of hard. It's so diverse, kind of hard to know what to call it. But I would say those two words cover it pretty well. Now, you wanted to talk about some of the designers, so I'm going to let you start that out. Yeah, I looked up all the names you gave me, and I have a little information on them. And I read up on them, but you talk about how do you want to approach this? Because you're in porcelain, let me just say, we're going to sort of start out with the porcelain works and go into some of the other stuff later.
Okay, well, let me just say that when I got interested in the porcelain factory at Alac, there wasn't that much information available, and it was around, I think, 1995, and I ended up going to Dachau, to the city of Dachau, and to the concentration camp to research the porcelain factory, which was in a sub-camp called Alac. And apparently Alac was also a small town next to Dachau, which was a town. So when I was coming in by train, the first stop before I got off at Dachau was Alac.
And so you're saying that Alac was a sub-camp of Dachau?
Yes, I am.
Okay, and what did they have prisoners there working or what?
Yes, they did, and it was liberated at the same time that the Dachau was liberated by that same group of the 42nd Rainbow Division.
Mm-hmm.
And the Alac porcelain factory. Now, the camp, the sub-camp Alac, I'm not sure. I don't think that the sub-camp and the porcelain factory were in the same place, to tell you the truth. But I'm not really clear on that.
Okay. Yeah, I kind of would question that because the porcelain factory was a real porcelain factory, and they had high standards, and they weren't probably wanting to, unless I can see that they might use some Dachau prisoners for some things that needed to be done there, but.
I found out that at Nuremberg they were questioned about using prisoner labor at the Alac factory, and they said no, that they hadn't used any. But the founder of Alac was a man named, one of the founders was Franz Nagy, mm-hmm. and he had owned this land that in Alac, somewhere near Alac, since 1925. So in 1935, he started the porcelain factory with Carl Diebitsch.
Yes.
And what's funny about Diebitsch is that he lived until 1985. He was born in 1899 and mm-hmm. Lived on until 1985, which is a pretty long life. And Nagy was a potter, and Diebitsch was a sculptor. and a designer. And Dibich has ran the was sort of the head of the design department at the factory.
The Alok factory was quite quite in tune with the National Socialist regime in Germany, wasn't it?
Yeah, because I mean, in 1936, Himmler acquired it. So Dibich and Nagy started it in 1935, but in 1936, it became part of the SS.
Oh, okay. Well, how interesting. And, of course, we know that Himmler was very much involved in Dachau. He's the one who started it and developed it. Well, I don't know if he started it, but he did develop it into wanting to do a lot of experimental farming and herb gardening. And he was very much into nature and animals and proper care of all of this.
Right. He was sort of an agriculturalist, was he not? A pig
yes.
farmer?
Yes, that's a good way to put it. Yeah. And so this is one. This was one. Now, people are probably familiar with Meissen porcelain. And
yeah,
Meissen is a very famous factory outside of Dresden. I visited that when I was there. But I had never heard of Alok. And I went to Dachau, but I didn't know anything about the Alok factory. I don't know if it's still there, though. It might not be there.
There's a building that's still there. And that was where when you say factory, it was an atelier, which means it wasn't a great, big, huge factory by any
yeah,
means. Was
right.
It like a shed or a series of sheds?
They call it a factory. They call these places factories, don't they?
Yeah, well, the full name was Manufaktur,
mm-hmm.
SS Porcelain Alok Manufaktur. So,
okay, well, let's talk about some of the work that was that they did there. How do we describe this to the listeners?
Well, let's just call them figurines. That was one of the things they did, and they also made commemorative plaques and plates and bowls to give to the officer class, I guess you'd call it, and other party officials. They were awards and gifts
mm-hmm.
given at Christmas time and also given at the rallies.
Yes, they were called presentation. Some of them were called presentation plates or plaques or this or that, where for being there or because of something special that they did, or they were part of a special group that did something. Like the one I showed in the newsletter, the Coburg anniversary plate. I'll just describe that for those who saw it. It's really a beautiful design, so simple. But if you just Google Coburg anniversary plate, you will probably come up with where that is, where I saw it, and you can go see it in a large color plate there. And it's really elegant. It has a swastika in the center and the sword coming down, pointing downward. But it says the plate was the history of it. In October, a German day was held in Coburg this is 1922. And Hitler, this was, you know, before Hitler became the chancellor, 1922, the early years, he arrived with 800 SA members, and they marched through Coburg, and the march soon became a street battle against the communists. They were victorious, I guess, and they always called it the Battle for Coburg. And it was commemorated 10 years later with a badge called the Coburg Badge. And then sometime in the 30s, they had this commemorative plate made to commemorate that anniversary. So things like that. There was just no end to it. And on that one site that you sent me, there were just so many pictures to look at. Of these items that were made, and they're so beautiful.
Well, there's a fellow that has just, I think last year, he finally got a book of Alok porcelain, two volumes published. His name is Dennis R. Porl. It's on part of the Schiffer Military History Books series, and these are full-color photographs of this stuff, and it's in two volumes.
Mm.
And anybody that's interested in SS porcelain, let's just call it SS porcelain because that's what it was. It was marked with the SS sigruns on the bottom of it. That was the company logo. They might want to look at these books online at the Amazon site or go to the Schiffer Book Company and look them up there. But these are deluxe catalogs of everything that was ever made by that company. And with the history, and actually they include photographs of the artists that work and photographs of the shops that sold the stuff and pictures of the molds. It's very comprehensive. I recommend it.
Well, talk about the designs and the products, the artistic products that they came out with, and compare them, you know, to others in other places. Porcelain is made in quite a few places.
I'd say that they had items for the home, for the people, German people, that you could buy candlesticks from them. You could buy, I think that, I can't remember what else that would go for the home, but there was a line of propaganda porcelain that included figures of the horsemen and uniformed horsemen, the Hitler Jugend, the boys and the girls in those groups. Then they also had kind of kitschy animals, dachshunds and deer and baby deer and little dogs, bears.
But they're beautiful little things. They're just charming as can be. You call them kitschy. That you know, that is kind of that way. But if, when you start to really look at them, you see how well done they are, and you'd really love to have one.
Well, they're very expensive now, of course, because they apparently a lot of this China. You know, there was, I came across an officer's Luftwaffe officer's mess plate with the insignia of the Luftwaffe on the top. And wherever the Germans were not liked, of course, and if they had any of this China around, this would be military China, not made by Alec, but just anything that had German insignias printed on it, it would be smashed, of course. So when you're talking about military, the porcelain and the regular dinner service that was Army dinner service, Navy dinner service, diplomatic dinner service, this stuff disappeared because it was broken or taken home as war booty.
Well, and if you think about what I was just reading about the bombing and the way they destroyed so much of the residential areas, then all this stuff, all these belongings that people had would be, you know, would have been lost. I mean, they were just lucky if they got away with their own life. They couldn't save much of anything.
Right.
Certainly not stuff like that. Well, you had wanted to talk about some of these personalities. We just talked about this fellow.
Diebitsch was the guy that was in charge of Valak, and he's an interesting designer because not only was he making this porcelain, he brought in a Theodor Karner, who was one of the top sculptors requisitioned them from Meissen. I think somewhere I read that you were like drafted to go to Alec if you were like at Meissen. I don't think Meissen was making anything during the war, to tell you the truth. They were hiding all that stuff underground, you know, because they were worried it was going to get bombed, and they actually succeeded in saving the Meissen collection. And the thing that people don't know about Meissen is that this is where porcelain, the Europeans came up with it was invented in Dresden by an alchemist whose name was Butker. And he was looking for gold, and he came up with porcelain. And prior to that, only the Chinese had the porcelain.
That's right. I remember that now from my
visit. The formula for porcelain. So this trade with China had a lot to do with bringing porcelain back to Europe on these ships. And it was used by the nobility. And in Spain and in Holland, and other places, Portugal, they came up with an earthenware approximation of the look of porcelain. They didn't know how to make it in Europe until 300 years after the Chinese had discovered that this ingredient that they need for porcelain making called kaolin, they didn't have that secret ingredient. And the Chinese weren't going to give it up, of course. So they made an earthenware china that they used to eat off of and carry water in and that kind of thing.
And then who discovered the kaolin? When did the Germans get hold of that? Figure that out.
In the 1500s. The Elector of Saxony, Augustus the Strong, he hired this alchemist named Boettger. I think his name is Friedrich Boettger, but don't quote me on the first name, but I know the last name is Boettger with omlauts over the O. He was looking for gold for the...
And he came up with it. So then the Germans had porcelain. They were the only ones.
They're the first ones to get it.
Yeah.
Listen, Boettger escaped and ran off to France and gave the formula to the French. Augustus the Strong sent an army and grabbed him and brought him back and kept him under house arrest for the rest of his life. It was a great story. Somebody should make a movie out of this.
Yes, and this Professor Karner is the creator of this SS rider that I had in the newsletter announcement for the program that I sent out. It's a beautiful piece, but I could only put a very small picture of it. That's all that I could find that was available. You can see a large picture of it there, but you can't copy it. So on that site about Alok, the one that you sent me. But it's very graceful, and it says that it was the its second one that they did. They have some others, and some of them are just all white, and the painted ones are far more rare now because there aren't very many.
I heard that Himmler didn't like them colored. He liked them all white.
Oh, did you?
Huh. Yeah.
That's interesting. Well, I didn't come across anything about that, he gave this one out for gifts. Let's do what? We've got just a couple more minutes before the end of this segment, Charles.
Okay, well, let me tell you about Diebitsch, because he did more than just design this porcelain. He also worked with the Hugo Boss company, the clothing company, and came up with the design for the Black SS uniform, and he designed the chain daggers. The SS daggers.
Okay, Diebitsch did.
Yeah, Diebitsch, and he worked with another designer named Walter Heck. And between the Diebitsch and Heck, I mean, those two made the SS look what it looks like. And the SS insignia was developed by a man named Walter. I just mentioned him, Heck, Diebitsch's partner there, in about 1932. So,
how interesting.
These two guys just worked this whole this look out, and that included the insignia, the uniform, and the daggers and the badges that they wore, and probably the cuff bands and some of the patches too, you know.
And this was all done down near Dachau.
I don't know where these I don't know where these guys were working before Diebitsch moved into moved into the porcelain.
Okay. This is before that.
Yeah, this is in 1933 he's joined the it's called the National Association of German Visual Artists. Reichsverband Bildenden Künstler Deutschlands. I don't have a very good German command of German, but yeah, he's working on all this before he gets involved with the porcelain.
Well, what about Kassberg? I thought he was also designing uniforms and all this stuff for the SS. Or was he designing for the Wehrmacht?
Kassberg was basically a flag designer.
Oh, that's right. He was designing flags. But you sent me a picture where he was drawing uniforms.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know what he was drawing on his drawing table, but... Mm-hmm. He's basically a designer who was as far as the Nazi period goes, he was famous for he designed a dagger, the SA dagger, which is you know, the Knight of the Long Knives. I never realized this until today, and that might be called the Knight of the Long Knives because of the daggers that the SA were wearing, you know.
Well, that's right. I saw a whole page I was looking at today of daggers. They were all SA daggers. So they had all these special designs for their daggers. So that was a big thing to them.
Yeah, it was a huge thing for the SA. And then I think the SS, you know, they were competing with the SA. So,
okay. Well, I don't want you to be cut off by.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Iran has started enriching uranium at a heavily protected underground site, according to the UN's nuclear watchdog body. The International Atomic Energy Agency reports that Iran has started the production of uranium enriched up to 20% at the Fordow facility. The US State Department spokesperson Victoria Nuland is calling on Iran to suspend its enrichment activities immediately.
This is further escalation of their ongoing violations with regard to their nuclear obligations, including the legally binding UN Security Council resolution.
Meanwhile, the United States government is calling for the immediate release of an American national sentenced to death in Iran. U.S.-based human rights activists have joined the condemnation of the case against Amir Mirzai Hekmati. The 28-year-old, who's of Iranian descent, was found guilty of spying. Our North America correspondent Malcolm Brown reports from FSN's Washington Bureau.
The American government denies that Mr. Hekmati, a former U.S. Marine, was a CIA spy. The man's family here in the U.S. says he was in Iran to visit relatives. The U.S.-based International Campaign for Human Rights in Iran is calling on the Iranian judiciary to rescind the death penalty and allow international observers to attend the appeal. Malcolm Brown, Washington.
Opinion polls suggest that Mitt Romney, the former governor of Massachusetts, is on course to win a sizable victory in Tuesday's New Hampshire primary. Republican voters there will be picking the candidate they want to lead their party into the November presidential election. Some of Mr. Romney's rivals claim he's insufficiently conservative to lead the Republican Party. But he's telling crowds in New Hampshire that he can beat Barack Obama in November.
This president is a crony capitalist. He's a job killer. He does not understand in his heart the passion of freedom and the power of freedom and opportunity. We have to make America, in every way we can, in every enterprise we care about, we have to make this the best place to be.
Rick Santorum, the former U.S. Senator from Pennsylvania who secured a virtual tie with Mitt Romney in Iowa last week, is already conceding the likelihood of a Romney victory in New Hampshire.
Mitt has the establishment here, and there's a very deep establishment here in New Hampshire that is, you know, committed to him from his time in Massachusetts to his time living here to having run 4 years ago and gotten, what, almost 35% of the vote.
And we will have full coverage from New Hampshire right here and on Twitter at Feature Story. A celebrity chef in Britain has apologized after being cautioned by police for shoplifting from one of the country's leading supermarkets. Anthony Worrell Thompson was arrested after allegedly stealing cheese and wine from a branch of Tesco's in Oxfordshire. He says he's let his family down with stupid and irresponsible actions and will seek treatment. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, listeners, to our second hour. And now we have our toll-free phone line open. The number you can call is 1-855-477-2283. You might wait just a little bit until we talk to George Stimson for a bit and learn about him and what he's bringing to the table here. And then if you have some questions or comments, do feel free to call in. George Stimson, is that right? Yes.
Stimson with an M, S-T-I-M-S-O-N.
Yeah, hi, George. Thanks for coming on. Now, I tend to want to say Stimson with a P in it, but that's not right. So that's why I was kind of stumbling
over.
That's
the most common misspelling.
I bet it is. Yes. All right. Now you do something that probably a lot of people don't know about because you have a blog, and I do want you to give tell people how to get to your blog.
Well, the blog is gpsjr.com, and just type it in and you're there.
That's right.
It's been on since about July, and it's just, you know, my version of my media coming out of my head, so I hope everybody likes it, gpsjr.com.
Yeah, I was there. I was reading it. I liked it. Okay, tonight we're going to talk about the fact that you edited some books on German militaria for a friend, and then you began editing a magazine he brought out. And you showed it to me, kind of, and it looks like a beautiful, very luxury-looking magazine, which comes out quarterly and is for people who not just German, but all military collectors. So tell us about that a little bit.
Well, yes, it's called the International Metal Collector, and it's been coming out for about 2 years now. A friend of mine who quit his job in Detroit to start publishing military books, decided to try his hand at a quarterly magazine, and so far it's been very well received. It covers all militaria from all countries and all conflicts, but the emphasis is on German militaria, both Imperial and Third Reich, because that is a huge area of interest in the military collecting market.
It is. And you say that you are a collector, too, and you have a pretty large collection. What's in your collection?
Well, that's true. I've been interested in this stuff since I was a teenager. I'm in my later 50s now, and I've collected for a while and then got out of it, and about 15 years ago got back into it. And mostly what I collect are Iron Crosses, and mostly from the World War II conflict. The decoration does date back to 1813, and it was reinstituted during the Franco-Prussian War and then during World War I. But most of my items are Iron Crosses or Iron Cross related, and then it spills over into other things because it can be quite an addicting hobby, and the material is very attractive to look at, and you do tend to stray out of your field and get this and that, helmets, tunics, flags, other things. I have some Kriegsmarine stuff, daggers, just a general assortment of things, but mostly Iron Crosses.
Okay, we were talking about daggers before you mm-hmm. came on. What can you tell us anything about daggers? We were talking about that they were quite popular with the SA, and they had a lot of designs.
I own about six or seven daggers, which I just got because I realized they cost about the same as a nice badge, and I got them to make displays. I'd get, for example, an SA dagger, like you mentioned, or one from the RAD or Luftwaffe or Heer, Kriegsmarine, and then put them in a case with several other items from each of those branches of service, and it just makes a nice little display. I like to, you know, have things around that look nice. I don't know that much about the history of them. I know there's one variety of SA dagger that they call the ground room, where they originally it had Ernst Röhm's name engraved in the dagger, and after the Night of the Long Knives, of course, he was no longer in favor, so everybody was grinding his name off the dagger blades, and those are quite desirable items if you can get one, and But the one I have is just a typical SA dagger, very, very nice piece, brown wooden handle, and very nice looking. Similar to the SS dagger, only brown, a lot less expensive.
I was going to ask you, well, I did ask you, and I wanted you to say, what are your favorite, do you have any favorite items among your collection?
You know, I was thinking about that after you did ask me earlier, and I'd have to say I'm very like the German cross decoration, which is sort of a grade of the Iron Cross between the Iron Cross First Class and the Knight's Cross, and it's a stunning badge, a star actually worn on the right breast pocket that has a huge enameled swastika in the middle of it. It's quite striking and quite attractive, and it was quite coveted both by the soldiers during the war who wanted to win it, and the collectors today want to have examples in their collection very much. And another badge I like is the Golden Party Badge, which is a small pin, perhaps circular, the size of a half dollar, with a gold wreath and then the black swastika in the middle surrounded by a red ring with Nationalsozialistische DAP written in it. It's one of the three decorations that Adolf Hitler wore. If you see pictures of him, it's the top pin that he's wearing above his Iron Cross. So those two are ones that kind of appeal to me aesthetically and historically.
And speaking of that, the three symbols, both of you tell me if you agree with this. It seems like the three major symbols used in all of this design is, of course, the eagle. And I'll just did a little search there, and the German eagle dates back to the time of Charlemagne. It certainly wasn't the Nazis who came up with the eagle. It's always been a German eagle.
Germans call him Karl der Große, by the way. And
yes,
people
that's right.
That so
Charles the Great, Carl, yes. Carl the Great, yes,
yeah,
and goes back to 800, and then the eagle is actually taken from the Roman army. So the eagle, you know, it's the Germans aren't the only ones that use the eagle, but they certainly did a lot of beautiful work with it, of beautiful designing with it, and then of course the swastika, which is more of the party, was the party symbol. Then the wreath that you mentioned on that party badge, the wreath or laurel circle, is often incorporated into the designs with the eagle and the swastika. Somebody's pushing papers around or something. Is that you, Charles?
Yep.
Okay. Well, it's making quite a bit of noise.
Okay.
Okay. Now, do you want to add anything, Charles, to this about these symbols and what you think? What are some of your favorite collector's items?
Well, I don't do much real collecting like George, but I did want to add that you were right back when we had our conversation about daggers, and we were cut into. Paul Kaesberg did design the SA dagger, the ROM dagger. I said that he was a flag designer, but he was also involved with the SA dagger and the U-boat war badge. He designed that, so.
Well, good. Well, I think he was extremely talented. He also did those wonderful etchings or graphic artwork. So he,
right.
You know, beautiful stuff that you sent me. I was not familiar with this man.
That stuff that I sent you is post war. I didn't see any dates on it.
Yeah, I imagine it is because, as you said, he kept working. For a long time after the war, he didn't have any problem, did he?
Well, no. I said that was Diebitsch.
Yes, but didn't Kaesberg also?
I don't. You know, I'm not up on Kaesberg's post-war.
Well, I think I read that his career continued, and you know, he was successful. So let's make clear that we tell the listeners that the swastika. Most people know this because it's been written about a lot, but it is really a symbol of the wheel of the sun. It represents life. It's totally positive. And I found something. It was originated in the Indus Valley, but I was reading something. I don't know where I've got that now, but that it was what you sent me, Charlie, about... one of these guys here,
Defke.
Defke, yeah, Defke one of the great German designers who's he was not really a National Socialist, and
he was, Carolyn. He joined the party.
Mm-hmm. Oh, he joined the party.
Yeah.
Well, they try to make out now like he didn't have anything to do with it, kind of. But he brought out the Hakenkreuz and worked with some designs with that. And it says in this thing that I read, whether they're right or not, because they like to put down Hitler, prior to its adoption by the Nazis, and when he had a version of the Hakenkreuz in a brochure.
Right.
And which he had published, and the Nazis chose it as their symbol, but they reversed it. Is that right?
That comes from
Assistant Mona Tress of the in the 1970s. She said that
Mona Tress wrote that. Right, she had wrote to Paul Rand, who was, I guess,
yes,
he was at the New York School of Visual Arts or something, and mm-hmm. she said that he had reversed it.
Yeah.
The German party had reversed Defke's design.
She also told him that
he would never have been paid for this design, but the swastika was in the public domain anyway, mm-hmm. so he didn't deserve to be paid.
No, that's right. And that there are all kinds of versions of it. And the one that they showed on that page by Defke, it didn't look like the one that's used. Is used on the Nazi stuff or on the flag or anything like that.
Well, it was. I mean, Defke, he put it into geometrical proportions, I think. That's what he's sort of known for doing. I mean, making it all geometrically equal.
I don't think anybody's ever going to have a final answer on that, you know, reversing it, doing this to it, that to it. The swastika has been around for thousands of years in countless different cultures. I have a very nice Paiute Indian basket that I found in an antique store near here that has the same swastika with the rounded arms that you'll find on the hilt of a Luftwaffe sword. So these designs have been around forever, and I don't think anyone can ever say, well, I came up with it. I actually have a little sub-collection I do of non-Nazi swastikas that you could find everywhere. They were being used left and right before Hitler adapted it and made it the most terrible thing in the world. So I've got postcards and little ephemera from companies that used it as their logos, and the Boy Scout good luck charms and everything else. The swastika has been around for a very long time in many, many different forms.
Yes, and you brought up, it's so interesting that I read, I don't know how many times today, because they adopted the swastika, it's ruined forever. It's now a symbol of evil, blah, blah, this nonsense that they keep promoting, you know, and of course it's outlawed and so on. Whereas, it's what I said in the beginning, it's old, it's totally positive, and you can't say that, and nobody can ruin it.
Well, most of that is in the Western world. It's my understanding if you go to India today,
that's
it's
true.
Practically on every other truck. So
yeah, I've been to India.
They don't have the same negative reaction that people do here.
But here,
it's all over China too. On the Buddha, in the middle of his breast, there you'll find a swastika. It can go both ways. The Dalai Lama, his throne has swastikas going in both directions.
Yeah, there's a temple over here near where I live called the Temple of the 10,000 Buddhas that literally has statues of 10,000 Buddhas in it, and each one of them has a swastika on its chest. So they could call it the Temple of the 10,000 Swastikas just as well.
Well, yeah, so that just shows what kind of garbage we're being fed.
Yes.
In the West, you know, about this is what my point was, that they want to say that, it can't ever be used. Oh, it's just a symbol of evil now. They took it and ruined it and blah, blah. Well, okay. Charles, do you want to talk a little bit about Willigut, Carl Maria Willigut? He's identified with occultism and the anti-Christian movement or something in Germany, but he didn't really design anything, but he did.
He put together.
He designed the Totenkopf ring.
Did he? Yeah, he designed the Totenkopf ring, which was the SS honor ring.
Mm-hmm.
He was in the SS, and he put together a rune dictionary. I think that's what he's probably best remembered for. So the SS Sigrun are the two marks, you know, that look like lightning bolts.
Yes.
That come out of this study of runology that Willigut published.
So is that a real rune symbol then? I didn't know that. I thought
that's
that
a double,
designed that.
It's a double Zig rune twice, and it's a rune, a victory rune, according to Willigut. He drew out all the runes. I guess they found the runes on rocks. I'm not really up on runology, but they're pre-Christian markings that were found all over Europe. And
yes,
he translated them, made an alphabet, so and assigned them certain meaning.
Well, even the Alok factory, which wasn't really a factory, but it's called a factory, manufacturers, they had a couple things that were pre-Christian type designs. One I liked very much called a ceramic Yule lighter.
Yeah.
And that's spelled J-U-L, Leuchter, or lighter. And I don't know where you put you stick a candle in the top is what you do. But it's a runish looking thing, but very nice design. And it says 100,000 of those were produced in 1938-39 alone.
Huh.
I would like to have that.
Is that the one that, you're sure the candle doesn't go inside of it, or does it go on
well,
top?
Well, that's what I thought. I thought that the candle would go inside and you would see the light from the, because it's got heart openings at the top and then some other kind of opening circle with like spokes in a wheel type thing at the bottom. And it's a... Well, it's hard to describe. It's kind of a squared off but soft edges shape. It sits kind of tall. And I saw a picture then of people using it, and there was a big candle stuck on top burning. It wasn't inside. And now I see in this one that there's a hole at the top to stick the candle in at the very top. So this is just kind of like a decorated holder.
I see.
But it's brown. It's brown in color. So that's the one I'm speaking of. But it's...
They made some really nice jugs that were brown in color. They weren't anything like the porcelain figurines that they were doing. They were more folkish, and they were covered in swastika patterns.
Well, you know, I used to think of figurines. My mother had some figurines around the house. Of course, they weren't porcelain. But I used to think of figurines as kitschy things, like you mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
After I went to the Meissen factory and looked at all of their stuff, and now I look at these and I see, you know, they're really such gorgeous works of art. They're different from what we think of as art in the, you know, paintings and sculpture and so on. But they're really beautiful. The things I don't care for are those, a lot of that wood carving, that German wood carving.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that gets a little rustic or whatever. I'm not crazy about that. But these porcelain figurines, is there anything more you want to say about them, Charles, or you, George, before we...
Well, I'll just say that Alok is very high-end in the collectibles market, and I've looked at a couple of sites and wish I could afford some of it because I think it's very nice.
It is nice, yes.
The detail is really refined, and so... When we're talking about figurines and kitsch, we don't want the listeners to get the idea that these are Kewpie dolls or something, because there's a lot of detail in it, and it's really done refined sculpting, but it's miniaturized.
The craftsmanship is really outstanding.
It's superior. It's the best best in Germany of the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's what the Germans are known for, is craftsmanship. They're not the only ones known for craftsmanship, but they certainly are excellent with detail.
Yeah, but listen, Carolyn, they're the ones that began making porcelain in the West. So they have a tradition of good craftsmanship, even dating back to when they made the first pieces of porcelain. They sculpted it. They also painted it. And everything that they did, even back when it was just getting started, is exquisite.
Yes. So, people, if you want to buy porcelain, buy German porcelain. Then you'll know you have the best. Okay, let's. There's a couple of things I find interesting in the designing field are the posters. And then, of course, there's the flags and banners, which more people are familiar with. But we could talk about some of that a little bit. And then we could get into some uniforms. And then maybe go back to weaponry if I don't know enough about that to talk about it. But I find these posters quite interesting. And I have quite a lot of them copied here on my page in front of me. And one of the best poster designers was Mjolnir. That was his kind of artist name. His real name was Hans Schweitzer. Are you familiar with the posters very much?
I'm not.
Okay.
I'm not either. I've seen some in books that are quite striking, but I've not gotten into them very much. I don't collect paper too much.
Carolyn, did Hans Schweitzer do portraits of soldiers?
Yeah, he would have soldier faces on a lot.
Yeah, I know
stuff.
I know his work.
Okay. Yeah,
I don't know anything about his life.
Here's one, Hans Schweitzer Mjolnir. It's a famous one that has the SA man's face and profile, and then right behind him, a little more forward is the Wehrmacht soldier, and there's they're both guarding the nation, something like that. This was a very popular one, but the theme.
I think I know that one.
Pardon me?
I said, I think I know that one from your description of it, but it sounds familiar.
Yeah. It's very familiar when you see it. And he did things in a real bold, simple kind of the way political cartoonists tend to do things. I mean, it doesn't look like a cartoon, but it's definitely not trying to be realistic or anything like that. And a lot of these posters, of course, this was the more common stuff. These were posters to were very political, very, very political. And they mostly all have a swastika in there somewhere, and flags. And there's a great one here that I have called Germany Awakes or Deutschland Erwacht. And it's just a man's face, and it's drawn in such a style. I don't know how to – it's red on white, and it's got a lot of line, with bold lines and so on. Very, very impressive. But some of these designs I wanted – of course, it's funny to talk about things people can't look at. But there are two of the posters that have a Christian theme, and I don't mostly they don't, of course. But these two absolutely do, and they're very well known too. One of them is the one with Hitler holding the flag standard, and the light behind him coming, like the light that shines on with a dove. It's actually an eagle flying above his head, but it's like the dove above Christ, and it's very Christological.
Yeah.
This one
is that the one where he's a knight?
He's not. No. He's in his Nazi uniform.
A brown shirt.
His party uniform. Yes.
Yeah.
And you see his belt and his waist, but then you don't see any more of his body. And then it's surrounded with a frame that's like laurel wreath type, but it's square shaped. And then it says underneath there, "Long live Germany" or "Erwache Deutschland." And then. The other one has got a soldier holding a swastika flag, marching along, and he's actually killing like a serpent. And behind him is a white form of the crusader, with a sword, doing the same thing. Or maybe it's the crusader that's got his sword in the serpent soldier or the SA man is just holding the flag, but it's comparing the two. That I thought that was interesting. Those are the only two like that I saw. But you can find all these posters at Calvin University EDU. What is that? Calvin German propaganda site.
Yeah,
they have lots of visuals there. That's where I got all these.
I think that might be the best propaganda, German propaganda website on the internet.
It is. It is. And they want to, you know, what they're trying to do is very different from what happens, because a lot of people really like what's there and they learn about it. I did want to say that the themes of most of this, of the posters, are usually the front soldier is a big theme, the worker is a big theme, the family, and sometimes the mother, and then the snake or serpent, you know, as the kind of the enemy or the evil. All right, well, we're coming up to our last segment. Ladies and gentlemen, I'll give the number.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
From making money now to losing it, as we ask whether it's time to let the public take over tackling the world's debt troubles. RT's Laurie Harfenest meets people in New York to get their tips for the politicians in charge.
Today, everyone's upset with how the world leaders are handling the economy. So how would you fix it? This week, let's talk about that. What country do you think is doing a good job?
Let me think. You don't know.
No, actually, I don't.
What would you do to fix the problem in Greece?
In Greece? Wow.
You don't know that one either.
You got some nice
No
questions.
One knows. No one knows.
No, but maybe that's why it's going all wrong.
A good work ethic fixes each of our problems personally. So if we're all out there working hard and spending money in the local communities, then that's, you know, our way of part of building up each local small community. Eventually, the whole country gets strong again, right?
Yeah, isn't it time maybe for the government to stop trying to fix it and let people and companies fix their own wallets?
I think that's a good answer, yes.
To fix the economy, what should they be doing?
They should be pumping more money into it.
Pumping more money?
Yes.
They've been pumping millions and billions and trillions.
It hasn't done any good.
So why is that the solution that we keep going back to?
The only thing they can do. That's
they could also just do nothing and let people sort it out themselves.
American people can't sort it out themselves.
It's not a matter of not throwing money into the economy. It's a matter of living within means. If you don't have enough revenue, then you have to cut spending.
Yeah, so governments are trillions of dollars in debts, so it sounds like they have no money.
Right. Well, they have to. They obviously, you can't stop everything all at once, but you do have to. You do have to pull back, and you have to come up with a reasonable plan to at least stop the hemorrhaging.
We don't just keep printing money, and that we don't keep inflating government. So that's in most of the European countries that are having trouble. It's because the government is 60% larger than it should be. So
why can you and I see this, and government leaders can't?
Because we don't get paid by the people that are behind the scenes. And since I'm not running for a campaign, I don't get campaign contributions by people that need my help, too. So
I reckon politicians are, they just all lie, really.
So what should they be doing better?
They're probably trying to change this economy from an oil economy to something else. We've got heaps of people with lots of brains, and we need to be doing something about the environment.
Do you think those people with brains are in positions of power?
Oh, no, no.
So it seems like with the system that's currently in place for how world leaders get elected, it might be time for solutions to come from someplace else.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back once again, ladies and gentlemen. We're in our last segment. So if you want to call in, the number is 1-855-477-2283, toll free. I'm here with Charles Kraft and George Stimson, and we are talking about visual things that's kind of difficult on the radio. But we're talking about the art, political art, and you might say decorative arts to some extent in the Third Reich. And now I've come to these flags, and the first flag I have here is the, I'm going to say this right now, the Deutschland Erwache Standard, Germany Awake. And this is supposed to be a Führer, for the Führer, when the Führer's around, but it's not the actual Führer flag. It's got the swastika with some lines lines around the outlining it in the center in a white circle and red background. It says Deutschland Erwache, and it's got a fringe around it. And then on the back, it says National Socialist Deutsche Arbeit Party, Arbeiter Party, and Sturm Abteilung. This is for the SA. This is a standard that the SA would carry around. You got anything to say about that, fellows?
I wish I had one.
It says it's an original flag designed by Adolf Hitler.
That I believe is true, right?
He did. He designed his own. Well, the Führer standard, he designed it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, which is the SA standard, same thing, right?
No. I don't think it's the SA standard at all. Here it is,
the Führer standard.
The Führer standard has two different eagles in four corners, and it would be it would be flying wherever he was, whether standing in a podium or it would be on the bumper of his car. It designated that he was right there.
That's right. Wherever he was, this was it. And it's a red background. It's got the same swastika with the outline around it. And it's got the gold wreath. So, and then the four eagles, two different kinds.
I think two of them are army eagles and two of them are party eagles.
Exactly right.
So then again, you have the blending of the party with the military.
And he designed this.
Yes, he did.
Well, who designed the SA standard?
I think that partially, if you'll notice, that's it's modeled after some of the standards that they used to carry in ancient Rome. So, but the specific designer who tweaked it into the Deutschland Erwache standard, I do not know.
It could have it might have been Kaseberg or Kasberg, because he was designing SA, he designed the SA badge, you know, the insignia, as well as the Rom dagger. So, why wouldn't he have done that too? He was a flag designer.
Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't copy down any more flags because there are so many of them. There are a lot of different kind of flags, but these are two basic ones. And it says that Deutschland Erwache is from a famous poem of the same name by Dietrich Eckart, who was one of the early National Socialists. Mm-hmm. And so that's that. Anything more you want to talk about flags? And I think you're right that Kasberg did design some of the flags.
There's I have a book of flags, and Kasberg is it. He's given credit for just about everything in the book. So,
yeah,
he was their flag designer.
Okay, well
I haven't read about anybody else except Adolf Hitler himself who designed flags.
All right, well I'll go with that. I think that sounds right. Now go ahead, George.
Oh, on the uniforms, there was another designer. Remember we said that Walter Heck and Karl Diebitsch designed the SS uniform. Well, there was another designer who was working with the National Ministry for the Occupied Eastern Territories. It was a brown uniform. His name was Egon Jantke. And the brown uniform can be attributed to Egon Yanke.
Okay.
So these are just names that interest me because they're sort of lost to history. And when you see something, it's interesting, you know, for a person.
Even in the field of collecting, there's not a whole lot of information on who specifically designed things. I know that Otto Plitzik designed most of the badges of the Kriegsmarine, but when it comes to the badges of the Army and the Luftwaffe, the people who came up with the designs, they are pretty much lost to history. There's reams of material on how they were supposed to be manufactured and the specifics of them and what they were supposed to show and everything, but no credit given to the people who came up with these spectacular designs.
They are beautiful. George, would you say that Adolf Hitler approved all of the designs of the badges or just some of them?
You know, my gut feeling is that he approved all of them. He had an interest in art. I think that he was a genius in recognizing the power of the swastika, and what he did with it is amazing. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's so put down today, is because I think people fear that it still has that same magic. So it can't be displayed. It can't be shown. If you go on an internet website to buy the German military that's coming out of Germany, they have all the swastikas covered up. If you go to a military show in Germany or where they're selling militaria, not only do all the swastikas have to be covered up, but if you're displaying a document that has the word Führer on it, the word Führer has to be covered up.
Oh, God.
So they are extreme, and they have police going through these military shows looking for violators.
Well, they can sell this stuff, but they have to keep it covered.
They can sell it as an historical item. I'm not sure what the West German now it's the German legal designation is it, but whenever you go onto a military site that's coming out of Germany, you have to click a box indicating that you have read and understand the German law regarding Third Reich military, that it can only be sold or obtained for historical reasons only and not for any matter of glorification of the Third Reich.
Well, that's really interesting. Okay, back to the SS uniform. It does have, they have a brown shirt and a black tie and black trousers, and then there's a black tunic. So when you have the tunic on, it looks like they're all in black, but there is a brown shirt underneath there. Unless some higher levels, this is the main uniform, some higher levels didn't have that brown shirt at all, or all in black.
I was reading about diplomatic uniforms being blue. So even the diplomats wore uniforms, and those were designed too. And I don't know who was designing for the diplomats, but they weren't overlooked either.
That Calvin site has a whole lot of uniforms. I found that just last night. Before I was looking on Wikipedia, they had a few. But you can't find, a kind of an art, a drawing of them where you can really see what it looked like on these collector sites.
Carolyn, do you know about that? There's a book that was put together by the DAP, which is the Reichsdeutsches Arbeitsfront, the work battalion.
They had nice uniforms, too.
Yeah, they sure did. Robert Ley was the head of that department. They have a manual, an organizational manual, that sometimes it's available. It's a rare book. It's a PDF download, and people can find it on the internet and look at the drawings of the uniforms, the badges, and the flags. It's sort of a branding manual for the NSDAP, the party.
There's an outfit called Bender Publishing, which specializes in books about, as you said, diplomatic uniforms, uniforms of the Reichs, Arbeitsdienst, all these little lesser-known aspects or divisions of the Nazi Party covered in full with uniforms, insignia, badges, flags, everything. It's a great publishing house. It's put out a lot of good information on some of this stuff that you would never find elsewhere.
Well, that's good information.
Yeah, Bender.
Good to know.
Bender, right?
Okay, Roger Bender. Somebody's, I'm hearing some feedback, but here is, there's also a gray SS uniform, which is called the, I've never seen one in, it's called the, well, where is it? I've got
Waffen SS?
The gray service uniform, SS gray service uniform.
Well, there were two divisions of the SS, the Allgemeine SS and the Waffen SS. And the Allgemeine SS wore black. They were the ones who were in charge of the concentration camps. And the Waffen SS was a fourth arm of the military, in addition to the Army, the Air Force, and the Navy. It's more of a fighting force in, at the front. So there were... The SS was split into two categories, Allgemeine or General SS and Waffen or Armed SS.
Well, I wonder what this – did they wear gray? I don't think they wore gray, although there was field gray. They were all in field gray, weren't they?
Yeah, the Waffen SS wore gray,
Okay, well, that might be what this is. Now, you know what I like in the German uniforms is the cap or the hat, that peaked hat. They had beautifully designed hats.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think part of the – there was a psychology in the peak to make them look a little taller, but I think that all of the uniforms are brilliantly designed. All of the awards are brilliantly designed. I mean, I – even amongst collectors, you know, this stuff is so desirable today. People want to have these things. And, you know, when you – when it was something you were wearing every day and it was your life and you were working and fighting to earn these awards, it was – quite a different thing, and they're so they just are attractive. I don't care the best dressers in history, I think.
And on top of that, they were meticulously made and sewn. I was looking at some pictures where they showed the actual tunics and the inside. They were all lined, and a lot of them were wool. There, a lot of these uniforms are made of wool.
Yes,
and they had linings, and they looked like very fine. You know, suits that you would buy. And
really
I thought, gee, you know, I just think of these uniforms as just some cheap thing that they give these people to wear. But they, you know, that
the
wasn't true at all.
Quality of the craftsmanship and the uniforms and the medals and badges and everything, it's just, it's outstanding. I mean, even the quality's gone so downhill today that these things are, they're works of art, really. Some of the awards are works of art.
I looked, yes, you're right, and I was looking at some of these things and the shoulder boards that are braided things and these badges and so on. They're so intricate when they show a close-up. You know, I've never actually looked at them in real life. And you think of all this stitchery that was done, and even all the flags and banners are made, beautifully made. So they somebody had to be doing that, and even if they used sewing machines, they must have had a bunch of women, you know, skilled women doing all this all the time.
Well, a lot of the insignia, rank insignia, and the cloth versions of the awards, which they wore because they were less bulky than the metal versions, were hand-stitched. They were individually crafted.
I think they were done in the concentration camps.
They did have women working as seamstresses in the
camps.
They
were making uniforms in some camps.
But they also, yes, they were. They would have to. But they also had German women doing it.
Yeah, they did.
You know, in
right.
Germany. So,
yes.
But yeah, that had, that's what I'm saying. That had to have been a huge production thing all in itself, just the uniforms and all this stuff.
They had companies that were contracted out to provide the army and the other armed forces with the uniforms. I mean, these were companies. I don't know their names, but there were a variety of them.
Yeah, and then there's the Totenkopf.
Well, you can find them inside the tunics and inside the caps. They put their manufacturers' names inside of them. So if you see some real ones, you can get the names.
Yeah.
Hmm. Anyway, the Totenkopf, the death's head, how does that fit in with the SS? Was that their symbol for every regiment that they had, or every group that they had, or is it just for special groups? There was a special division.
They wore it on, everybody wore it on their cap. It was the bottom insignia under the eagle and swastika. There was a Totenkopf division. The death's head goes way back into German history and other European history, the Hussars and everything else. I'm not that familiar with it, but it's kind of a... it's an unusual emblem which seems to fit the general impression of what the SS was about.
Well, because it was till death, you know, yeah. Right? You know, it's, yeah. You know, I maintain my
loyalty.
My loyalty and my defense and so on and to death. And right. Yet it's portrayed that there's some kind of occultish death wish or love of death and so on.
Yeah.
It's so wrong. Well, we can go back to the daggers, because is there anything more to talk about with these daggers? And what about other weaponry? Is there anything to say about that?
Well, there's swords. They had nice swords, and those were pretty elegant. And officers carried swords.
They did.
I'm not up on it, but I'm sure that the quality of the swords was commensurate with the quality of everything else that they made.
It was. I have a sword from the Kriegsmarine. That's the only one I have, but I've seen quite a few, and they're, you know, everything is just so well made and crafted. It's remarkable.
Yeah, I'm looking at a page here that I one online. It's a military reference, German blades. It's the history of the SA dagger. It's got a lot of pictures, and they're quite beautiful. I can see why people would want them. And it says, alles for Deutschland on the blade.
Yes.
And there are quite a few of them. Yeah, craftsmanship is something that is craftsmanship going out of style, and this is one reason why people want to collect all these things.
Well, the craftsmanship has gone out of style. If you look at the 1957, the then West German government permitted the reissue of Third Reich era badges to be worn by veterans who were then in the Bundeswehr, but they were all denazified, which meant removing either the swastika or the eagle and swastika. And when you look at these badges and medals compared to the original wartime versions, the workmanship is just terrible. They're shoddy, they're tinny, they're just, it's hard to believe it's devolved so much. You generally think of things getting better, but in this instance, they just got worse. And, you know, compared to the originals, there's just nothing there. And I would imagine a veteran would be quite disappointed to have to wear some of these things, because often they look ridiculous without the eagle and swastika.
There was no polyester in those days, Carolyn.
Well, that's right. So did they have cotton uniforms? I mean, the wool would be nice and warm in the winter.
Yeah,
they had summer uniforms. I know that.
Yeah.
I guess they were made with some kind of
cotton. Probably.
Yeah.
Cotton duck.
Yeah, I'm not up on uniforms too much.
Well, what are you up on?
Well, like I said, mostly Iron Cross. But getting back to daggers, you know, you mentioned that the SA dagger had "Alles für Deutschland" engraved in the blade, except for the army dagger and the Kriegsmarine. A lot of the daggers were engraved, but especially the party Nazi party themed daggers, like for example, the Reichsarbeitsdienst had their motto "Arbeit erdelt, work ennobles" engraved on the blade. I believe the SS dagger had "Meine Ehre heißt Treu," "My honor is loyalty." On the blade, I believe the Hitler Youth dagger had "Blut und Ehre," blood and honor, engraved on the blade. So that's one characteristic of the blade that the ceremonial daggers had, was the motto of the respective organization on it, engraved into it.
George, couldn't you get accoutrement for your dagger that was extra when you went to pick it up? You get a special hilt or scabbard or a chain?
I think there was a lot of things about that, especially when it comes to engraving the blade. I know that especially Navy blades have been quite elegantly engraved with leaves and filigrees and things like that. So I'm not that up on the port-a-piece and the hangers and things like that, how much of that was issue stuff or private purchase. But, you know, there was a lot of artistic leeway in these things.
Yeah, I'm looking right now at one that says the design of the High Leader dagger was very similar to the Honor dagger. Anyway, it's got all this engraving on the blade. And then it shows very close up this chain that's on the scabbard or whatever you call that holder. Quite elegant. It's links of little squares with a swastika in each square.
Oh, yeah.
To hang it, you know, to hold it onto your uniform or something.
Yeah.
But didn't the soldiers carry daggers? Didn't they all have a dagger?
They wouldn't carry them in front. For the most part, daggers were for officers. As far as I believe, I could be mistaken about that, so I'm going to say don't quote me. I'm trying to think that officers had daggers and enlisted men did not.
I think
they would have something.
I was reading about hundreds of thousands of SA daggers being made, and SA men would go to these distribution points. They'd have to pay for those things themselves.
Oh, yeah.
They could pick up extra ornamentation to go with their dagger for extra money. They wore them in formation in parades.
You're talking about SA. I was thinking more of the military branches like the Army and the Luftwaffe, which I don't believe that enlisted men got them. But you're right. The SA, and of course there were hundreds of thousands of men in the SA, so they would have that many daggers made and an unlimited variation on them. I would think.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
A lot of different manufacturers of them. I know that for sure.
I read 200 different companies were issuing SA daggers of different.
Well, here's Paul Kessler's name. The funds
were consolidated into one company. Only one company was allowed to stamp those daggers in the end. There was too many people making them.
Well, here's a dagger that says was designed by well-known artist Paul Kessler, manufactured exclusively by the Carl Eichhorn Company. Carl Eichhorn was a big dagger maker.
Yes. Yes.
Is that a Feldernhall dagger? The SA Feldernhall dagger for Victor Lutz? Yes, it is.
Yeah. Yes, it is. Yeah.
Is there a squirrel on their logo?
I don't see the whole thing. I'm just seeing a little piece. I don't see a squirrel.
Okay.
But yes, the Eichhorn, that's right. Their logo was a squirrel. I read that somewhere yesterday or today. That was a play on the whatever Eichhorn means, which means acorn.
Acorn, right, yes. Uh-huh.
Okay. Well,
I just want to add, speaking since you brought up oaks, I would include the oak leaf with the iconography of the Reich along with the swastika, the laurel wreaths to some degree, but the oak leaf was another big design issue in a lot of the badges, and some of the decorations like the Knight's Cross even had oak leaves as a higher grade. So just let me throw that in as a footnote.
Well, I'm glad you did. That's very correct.
A wreath of oak leaves around the Führer standard, right?
I think so. Yeah. And then a lot of the war badges had oak leaves going up one side and laurel leaves going up the other side.
Oh,
how interesting. You know, these things become so, there's so much thought put into it. And so much symbolism, you might say. Really very, very interesting. Well, here's some common manufacturers of the Rome dagger. Of course, all these daggers for the SA, I guess, were called the Rome dagger. Eichhorn, EP&S, F. Dick, Henkels, Wusthof, Herder, and Esculap. Esculap, that.
Henkel is still making knives. You know that?
Yeah, they are.
The Henkel knife is a famous culinary implement that's still being made. And
The one with two men on the blade. The ones with one man on the blade are made in Brazil.
Oh, really? Well, yes. Willem Defke designed that the logo for that, the two men.
Yes.
There's two little stick figures.
That's right. Yeah, you can get Nazi daggers with those.
Oh, can you?
Yeah.
The Henkel trademark, eh?
Mm-hmm.
Well, George, tell us again the name of your magazine and a little something about it in case people want to look for that magazine.
Well, it's called the International Metal Collector, and it's sold by B&D Publishing, which
is that metal like an M-E-D-A-L or metal?
Yes,
like
International Metal Collector.
Okay.
And it's you can go to ironcross1939.com and get it.
Okay. Well, we have come to the end of the program, gentlemen, and I want to thank both of you very much, Charles Kraft and George Stimson, for joining me for this very interesting program. We'll see if... And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.